Hello, and welcome to the Green Book Commentaries Podcast. I'm Dr. Arthur Plessa. Volume 14, Episode 21, Getting High with an 8. Doctors of Chiropractic and Student Initiates, welcome back and thank you for joining me. Over the previous episodes, we have been focusing a lot of attention on poisons and their effects upon tissue cell health. In today's episode, we are going to conclude our discussion on poisons, and as the title suggests, learn how innate responds to drugs. With this episode, we also conclude the sophomore section of Volume 14. So we are now officially halfway through this green book, and I've already received messages on Facebook and Instagram about which green book we're going to cover next. As of now, we have covered The Science of Chiropractic in Volume 25 and are going through The Philosophy of Chiropractic in Volume 14. So it would only make sense to move on to The Art of Chiropractic next. However, as you know, BJ made a lot of developments to the art, from where he started with full spine to where he concluded with upper cervical specific. So do we begin first with Volume 13, The Art of Chiropractic, and learning BJ's full spine technique? Or do we go to Volume 18, The Subluxation Specific, The Adjustment Specific, and discuss BJ's upper cervical technique? As always, you, my amazing listeners, will get to choose. I will put up an online voting request on our Facebook page, and as we get closer to completing Volume 14, if you haven't already done so, find us on Facebook at the Green Book Commentaries and place your vote. So let's get moving into today's episode then, shall we? Getting High with an 8. And here with me today is Cheech and Chong to provide some insight into this topic. No, just kidding. They're still up in smoke. When you hear the phrase, getting high, college students are likely reminiscing of what they smoked at their last party, and the older adults are having flashbacks from their former years. Yes, we're talking about smoking weed and drinking alcohol. But we're also talking about prescription drugs, from analgesics to laxatives. What is the common response from innate intelligence when you're smoking weed or when you're taking prescription drugs? To answer this, we turn to the philosophy of the drug habit, as developed by BJ Palmer. According to Webster's Dictionary, a habit is, quote, an aptitude or inclination for some action in increased facility of performance or decreased power of resistance, end quote. In other words, a habit is something done without conscious effort, which is either beneficial or detrimental. Working out at the gym is beneficial. While doing so, once leaves you sore and tired, a continuous schedule of working out leaves you with a toned physique and better energy levels. Smoking tobacco or weed is detrimental. While doing so, once leaves you with a buzz, continuous exposure lowers tissue cell resistance. When a drug is consumed, innate treats it as a poison, creating an antidote and adapting the serum to better balance the drug's effect. So this leaves a person in a semi-poison state where a drug is affecting tissue cells and lowering their resistance, while innate is reformulating the serum in an effort to neutralize that drug. What happens to a person who takes drugs regularly? Innate becomes accustomed to constantly keeping the serum in an adapted state to better reduce the drug's effects upon tissue cells. This leaves the user in a state of being poisoned with lower resistance. Since innate is constantly creating antidotes to reformulate serum, this also leaves tissue cells in an exhaustive state. Now, what happens to a regular drug user who suddenly decides to quit cold turkey? For anyone who has seen Leonardo DiCaprio's film, Basketball Diaries, you can get a general idea of the anguish that hard drug detoxing has upon the body. However, what is exactly going on under the pain and the cold sweats? We said earlier that for every drug consumed, innate will reformulate the serum, adapting to that drug in order to rebalance body chemistry the best it can. The process of drug detoxing takes time before innate can bring back to normal the remanufactured serum. Until such time has occurred, the reformulated serum is actually a poison. Innate is really busy now, eliminating the drug, which became a poison when consumed, and restoring normal serum quality, which is a secondary poison, until normal values have been restored. This process occurs with the recreational drug user and the habitual one, time and quantity being the only difference. So this all sounds great for the next anti-drug DARE campaign, but is there a practical side to this in a chiropractor's office dealing with patients? Regular drug users, whether it be prescription or recreational, keep their tissue cells in a poisoned condition. For chiropractors who use spinal thermography to detect subluxations, you all will find that these patient types are more consistently in pattern and have a lot of difficulty holding their adjustments. The proposed mechanism of subluxation by drugs is that tissue cells can function normally due to being poisoned. Correction. The proposed mechanism of subluxation by drugs is that tissue cells cannot function normally due to being poisoned. The tissue cells of the soft tissue structures, which interconnect vertebrae, are not structurally strong anymore, and as a result, cannot support normal juxtaposition. No, muscles don't pull vertebrae on their own accord into a subluxated position, as that would be a violation of Principle 25, which states that innate forces are never injurious to the body. In other words, innate does not subluxate itself. What occurs is an imbalance in paraspinal soft tissue strength and resistance, causing a subluxation to occur against innate's best resistance using poison tissues. So, what would this case look like in your practice? The average adult patient in a chiropractic office is on one painkiller and 2 to 3 medications for a chronic disease, like hypertension or type 2 diabetes. You do your chiropractic analysis, detect a subluxation, and adjust it. The patient returns a few days later, likely mentioning the good sore spots along the spine that occur post-adjustment, and often report feeling better. Now, you check for subluxation, and despite the patient not recalling any new injuries, discover the same subluxation has returned. This patient will likely require more adjustments initially before they begin to hold. However, with drugs still in their system, they will only improve so far, with symptoms likely returning with increased levels of stress or activity. Slowly, as the patient discontinues the use of medicines, their adjustment will hold longer and their condition has the potential to completely resolve. It is for this reason why patients at the BJ Palmer Research Clinic were required to discontinue the use of all medications. Medications poison tissue cells, subsiding one condition while causing another, and preventing innate from restoring normal body chemistry, which in turn keeps the patient sick. The best results will always be with patients who are taking no medications, and the focus of care is subluxation removal. When we return from our break, We'll begin with volume 14. We now begin our reading from volume 14, page 152. Article 202, Habit. Quote, an aptitude or inclination for some action, an increased facility of performance or decreased power of resistance. End quote. Reference, Webster. There are good habits and bad habits. A habit is classed as good or bad, according as it is beneficial or detrimental to a person or to his associates. A habit is acquired by doing the same act repeatedly until it no longer requires an act of conscious will to bring it about. For that very reason, it requires a very strong act of conscious will to change a habit. If there are subluxations affecting the normal exercise of the educated will, it will be much harder to change a habit or to break a habit. In Article 200, is shown a condition that is impossible to change without adjustments, especially if the educated mind is weak in will. It does not necessarily follow that if a person has a strong habit, which he has not the will to change, he is weak-willed in all things, for it is the cardinal characteristic of a habit that it requires more will to change it than any other act. According to some psychologists, a habit is the very tiny evolutionary beginning of an instinct, or it is easy to understand that an instinct is not easily changed. Article 203, the philosophy of the drug habit. Drug habits are such as smoking, tobacco chewing, snuff habit, coffee, tea, alcohol, stimulants, and opiates. The example used here is the acquiring of the tobacco habit. The poison is first taken, and innate shows her contempt and displeasure by ejecting the contents of the stomach and vigorous elimination through the excretory organs. Some tyro smokers notice that the action of the bowels is accelerated. The first repulse is shown in Article 199. If the dose with some drugs is strong enough, the result is shown in Article 200. A subluxation will result in the latter case. Immediately, the mechanical demonstration of innate's displeasure has taken place. She begins to form an antidote for the poisons that have remained in the system. Then the drug dose is repeated. Innate again may rebel. In the beginning of smoking, she does not always do so mechanically. Having started making antidotes, she continues the process. As the doses are repeated, innate just as repeatedly creates the antidote so that the serum will be chemically balanced, even with the presence of the nicotine. In time, the manufacture of antidote is a continuous process, in expectation of the regular or constant repetition of the drug. A failure to take the drug, therefore, leaves an unbalanced antidote, which then becomes a poison, and the habit victim becomes distressed because of it. Innate makes an imperative demand for the drug. It seems strange that innate would demand a poison, but now it is something that she requires in metabolism to neutralize the poison already there. From this demand of innate's, made known by strong desire for the drug, arises a craving that is very difficult to deny. It requires a vigorous effort of the will, even with strong-willed persons, to deny it. If, however, this is done and the body gets no more of the drug, innate will proceed to destroy the antidote and cease making it. But during that time, the case suffers the torments of cravings. One of the factors that makes it so easy to give in to the craving and so hard to deny it is the force of habit. Thus, there is a double battle for the will to deny the craving, and the will to change a habit. Subluxations play their part in all this in the matter of incoordinated educated mind, poor elimination, and inadequate adaptation in the matter of balancing drug and antidote for every day's struggle. Article 204, Medical Habits. A medical habit is the habitual use of a treatment to the detriment of the body. This includes the habitual use of pills, patent medicines, opiates, cathartics, enemas, and artificial foods. The use of pills and cathartics accustoms the intestines to profuse secretion in order to dilute the poisons and flush the bowels of them. These drugs are poisons. Innate does not want them there and gets rid of them in this manner. Quote, salts do not move the bowels, but the bowels move the salts, end quote. Reference Palmer. Repeated doses of this get the bowels into a habit of heavy secretion of fluids and lessened peristaltic action. The muscles of the intestines of chronic pill users are almost entirely inert. The too frequent or continuous use of the enema also has the same effect upon the muscles of the rectum. Some users of patent medicines have made of themselves drunkards and drug addicts. True, they did not have that particular reputation, but they had to have regularly their particular patent medicine with its high alcohol content or its opiates or other poisonous drugs. The users of overprepared foods, artificial foods, can become addicts to them, for they get certain digestive organs into the habit of shirking, which causes them to become abnormal, weakened, or depleted through non-use. And then, when they are called upon to do their natural work, they suffer a great deal. Article 205, Intellectual Adaptation. Intellectual adaptation is the mental process of innate intelligence to plan ways and means of using or circumventing universal forces. This mental process is made manifest or expressed through change in organic matter. It is the universal law of change which governs adaptation. Organic matter is the only kind that requires adaptation to protect its structural values. The essence of this intellectual process is preserved in the race of the organism in an accumulative manner called survival value and is the fundamental principle of evolution. We study intellectual adaptation by its expression, manifestation, namely adaptation. Article 206, Adaptation. Adaptation is the movement of an organism or any of its parts, or the structural change in that organism, to use or to circumvent environmental forces. Adaptation is a continuous process, continually varying. It is never constant and unvarying, as are other universal laws. Adaptation is a universal principle, the only one of its kind. It is the principle of change, and the changes are always according to law, which is intellectual adaptation. For an exhaustive treatise on intellectual adaptation and adaptation, the student is referred to Article 155, Volume 5. It cites many good examples, the acclimatization of plants and animals, the growth of hair on bodies for protection, the forming of calluses on hard-worked hands, the strengthening of tree roots on the windward side. These are all examples of adaptation to forces, which, if they had not been thus opposed or circumvented, would have proven destructive. These organisms strengthened their structure where it was most needed. That is, their innates did it, so that they were able to withstand future stresses of that kind. Note that the organism successfully meets these stresses for a given moment, but the strengthening of the structures is not done instantaneously for that particular moment. It is done to provide for the next time. This gives a positive value that is transmitted to posterity. Article 207, Inheritance of Disease. Inheritance of disease is not a chiropractic tenet. Chiropractic holds that disease cannot be inherited because it is not a value, but a lack of value. Disease is lack of adaptation. There is no constructive survival value, no evolutionary values to inherit in that case. Diathesis is not a disease. It is but the inheritance of type, of forms of family characteristics, the same as one could inherit the shape of nose belonging to his father or grandfather. If one has a diathesis for tuberculosis, that does not mean that he has tuberculosis or that he is obliged to have it. The term is used to indicate that such a person has a body with a low resistance to that kind of disease. True, this one's parents may have had tuberculosis. The offspring of those parents with a family resemblance will have the same kind of tissues, with a likeliness in strength and resistance. He will have the same type of spine, subject to the same subluxations. If subjected to the same environmental conditions that his parents had, perhaps living in an unhygienic or unsanitary quarters, he will have the same adaptive battles to fight that they did. He is likely to overcome in the same way they were. If, however, he seeks to improve on the hygiene and sanitation of his family, he is no more likely to have tuberculosis than anyone else. There is another question that is commonly presented. How about leprosy, syphilis, etc.? Are not the germs inherited, and do not the children of syphilitic parents have this disease? Yes, but not always. A mother supplies the fetus with nutrition by serum, not blood, through the placenta. That is one of the functions of the placenta. It provides a serous nutrition upon which the fetus thrives and grows. Obviously, the environment of a developing fetus must be normal and natural, supplying clean food by the same principle that the adult human must have a suitable environment. We have seen that a human adult body cannot use impure or putrid or poisonous food, neither can the fetus. If the mother's serum conveys the germs of a disease, as syphilis, to the fetus, of course it is possible for the fetus to have them in its body. From this point on, it depends upon the resistance of the tissues of the fetus. The germs very seldom get the start then. If there are subluxations in the child, they do. If not, the germs lie dormant. The child may grow to adulthood, and often does, before the disease shows. It would not then if at some time the tissue resistance were not lowered. Just think how many people reach the age of 20 or 25 without having sickness of some kind which lowers resistance. How many people are without kidney place subluxations or subluxations of some kind? Even then, the tissue resistance may be too great for the germs to gain a foothold, and the person may live out his life untroubled. True, it may be said that the child inherited the germs. For that matter, he may inherit many kinds of germs, but germs are not disease. He may have inherited the diathesis, but not the disease. Without the subluxations that lower his tissue resistance in that particular respect, he will never have the disease, which is said to be inherited. Thank you for joining me for another episode. I'm Dr. Arthur Plessa. This has been the Green Book Commentaries Podcast.